On this episode of Big Boys Don't Cry, we discuss the film Ruby Sparks. You don't have to have seen the film to enjoy the podcast, but if you do proceed and listen without having seen it, just be aware that we do discuss some elements of the plot and there'll be spoilers. Enjoy. There you are.
Hello.
I just got a notification saying Robert Gordon is extremely online.
It is absolutely accurate. I am extremely online.
By which you mean the internet is plugged into your veins. So, you know, people are worried about, like, people looking at their phones all the time, but you've gone one step further and just plugged it in. It's like, give me internet now. It's like a drip going into you all the time.
As the mighty Linkin Park once said, they are one step closer to the edge, and I'm extremely online.
I thought you were going to say, I tried so hard and got so far, but in the end it didn't even matter, because I'm extremely online.
Nothing matters when you're extremely online.
Yeah. I remember their videos used to actually kind of freak me out when they were first on. The Hybrid Theory era, they did lots of scary videos where they've all got spiky hair and they're all like sort of like rapping at the camera in alleyways and stuff. And I actually thought they were like bad dudes.
But in a good way. Super bad dudes. Bad dudes in the same way of Bad Dudes versus Dragon Ninja. did you ever play?
Oh yeah.
Bad Dudes versus Dragon Ninja.
Oh no. I thought you were talking about the band Lost Prophets.
No, they are actual... Well, one of them is an actual bad dude.
One of the worst people in history.
Yes. Bad Dudes versus Dragon Ninja was a sort of a side-scrolling beat-em-up game where there's these two bad radical dudes against an evil gang of ninjas called the Dragon Ninja who have kidnapped the president.
Can we get them to come back like now and kidnap the president now?
I think we should.
The big wet president.
I was hoping that Prince Charles would secretly be a member of Dragon Ninja, but unfortunately not.
He's definitely a ninja, Prince Charles. He's definitely got the build of a ninja.
So it has the best sort of opening like scroll ever in a game, where obviously it was the 80s where there was a certain president in place, which is why he's called this. But basically there's this guy with sunglasses
Rupert Rodine.
President Ronnie is his name, thank you very much.
President Ronnie
has been kidnapped by the ninjas. Are you a bad enough dude to rescue Ronnie? And that is your mission for the game.
Good old Ronnie.
Yeah. And then at the end, he sort of says, like, hey, dudes, thanks for saving me. Here we go. Hey, dudes, thanks for rescuing me. Let's go for a burger. Ha, 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 ha. And that's how the game ends.
Cowabunga.
It's amazing. 80s video games, man. That's where it's at.
Yeah. You can't beat them.
You cannot beat a good 80s video game.
By which I mean you literally can't beat them because they're all so bloody impossible to finish.
That is the amazing thing about all the classic games, isn't it? Is that all of them were either ported from the arcades or were still being made with the mindset of arcade game development. So their sole purpose to exist was to steal quarters from kids' pockets.
Yeah.
And that's why they were there. And that carried over into games that never even appeared in arcades as well. Like the Mario games with their live system. That all was revolved around how it worked in an arcade setting. Which is why so many of them were so difficult. And also it was an attempt to sort of build longevity into them. Because whereas now you can have like a 90-hour long video game, then it was, well, this game takes 40 minutes to beat, but you're going to be trying it 100 times before you beat it.
Yeah, it's like it's kind of like an American football game. It actually only takes 5 minutes, but you have to stop every 10 seconds for someone to move the ball.
Yes, whereas this, it's stopping every 10 seconds because you died and you have to start over.
Yeah, I don't mind the American football game that's on the NES Mini that I got. It's actually quite fun.
Is it Tecmo Bowl?
I can't remember what it's called.
Because I think that's the classic of the of that era. I have no time for sports games before the 16-bit era. All of them play horribly.
If it doesn't have Bobson Dugnut in it, I'm not interested. It,
if there's no Mike Truck, I am not getting involved.
Although on that subject, as a as an early Father's Day present, my month-old son got me something baseball, Acclaim Baseball 2001 for the Game Boy Color, because I had a Game Boy Color, and it's actually not bad.
Oh, very nice.
I can hit home runs in it, which is more than can be said for my ability in baseball in any other context. But yeah, 2001, it does make the kind of NES era games seem ridiculously hard and awful.
Yeah, exactly. I have been building, as well you know, Paddy, but for our listeners,
You've been sending me awful photos of your handiwork.
I have created a little retro console. It's very, very easy to do if you have a Raspberry Pi, which is a tiny little computer. It's effectively a tiny little circuit board. You can then create a retro device out of it where you can play various, you know, retro console games on it. So I have everything from the Nintendo to the Sega Master System to the Mega Drive to the Super Nintendo, with Game Boy games, Game Boy Color games, some Game Boy Advance games, and now some original PlayStation games on it as well. And the sole purpose of this was to annoy Paddy by putting on the greatest video game of all time, Tokka Touring Cars 2.
You bought the Raspberry Pi just to annoy me.
Yeah,
for this. Just so
I could send you a picture of me playing Tokka Touring Cars 2, the greatest video game ever made.
Yeah. The most accurate video game ever made in terms of how it represents driving, which is the most boring, frustrating, and tedious thing that one has to do as a person without any real problems in the Western world.
If you have ever wanted to know what it feels like to drive an Audi around a British racetrack in the rain, Tokka Touring Cars 2 is the game for you.
We've all thought about it.
No, I love Tokka Touring Cars. I'm going to thoroughly enjoy playing that alongside everything else. I think I'm not sure what I'm going to do first because I'm very busy at the moment, but I think I'm going to eventually move on to playing all of the Mega Man games. Nice. or working my way through all of the Mario games or something like that. But there's also some classic games that I never got around to playing as a kid, which I am going to be thoroughly enjoying, which is going to be awesome.
A completist.
I will be the man who completes things.
Then you find possibly that like, the games that you didn't play when you were a kid have a certain allure to them. It's either they're really, really interesting because you didn't have them, or you hate them because you didn't have them. The same with Disney movies. Like, if you didn't watch particular Disney movies as a kid in the 90s, only 90s kids will remember this, then, yeah, you have no time for them. Like, Claire has no time for The Black Cauldron or Oliver and Company or those ones that I like because she never saw them as a kid and is just like, what is this rubbish?
Okay, because I think particularly things like that where your mind is shaped by processing them as a kid, when you go back to try and watch those things without that kid lens on, they don't really have the same luster to them, do they? Although personally I'm not a fan of Oliver and Company in general. As a kid I didn't really like it.
Are you fucking kidding me? It's the most underrated Disney film ever.
The most underrated Disney movie ever is The Black Hole. That is the most underrated Disney movie ever. Everyone talks about Tron. Oh, Tron's so good. Oh, look at the Tron. Tron, Tron, Tron. No.
That's the voice of Tron fans.
Oh, Tronny, Tronny, Tron, Tron. I love Tron.
Which is quite similar.
Isn't Tron
to
so good?
The voice that you put on for like Brexit people.
Well, I think that Venn diagram is pretty much a circle, let's be honest here. Brexit loves Tron.
Boris Johnson fucking loves
Tron. He loves Tron. He's all about Jeff Bridges and is like, oh, I wish I could be in a virtual wonderland.
He watches it at least twice a week.
Yeah, he's just there with his horrible hair and his big gammony face.
That's why he's never prepared for anything that he does ever, because he's too busy watching Tron. His aides come in and they're like, come on, we've got to brief you on this thing. It's really, really important. Like, there's been a disaster, a big like oil crisis or whatever. And he's like, oh, sit down here and watch Tron with me, Johnny.
Look, it's the light cycles. Isn't it fun? No, you know, Tron is for the vanilla ice cream crowd. If you're all about pistachio ice cream, if you've got a refined palate, Black Hole's where it's at. Black Hole's where it's at. That's the real money maker. Go watch it. It's got robots. It's got killer robots. It's got a big black hole. It's got weird, spooky stuff going on. It would definitely scar you if you watched it as a kid.
That's how it gets into your good books. If it's just exactly. Like really traumatic and scarring.
Exactly. Exactly.
Whereas all I want is a dog voiced by Billy Joel. I'm easily pleased.
Speaking of dogs, did you know that there was a Beethoven video game on the Game Boy?
What?
I have kept it on my device. I was thinking, I should probably delete this because it's almost definitely going to be trash. But I thought, you know what? I need to keep it on there for the next time that I see Paddy that he can play it and we can witness the glory of Beethoven on the Game Boy.
That's extremely my shit. Is it really bad?
I haven't played it yet. I've reached a stage now where I'm going through and whittling down what games I want to keep on it and which ones I don't, so that I can make more space for... I'd like to fit a couple more PlayStation games on, but that means deleting about 100 to 200 more like SNES games. And it's basically getting rid of all of the American football games and baseball games, to be honest.
Oh, no.
I'm gonna keep... I think there's one baseball game that I seem to have fond memories of where it was like future baseball where you played as a load of robots.
Oh yeah.
And so the gameplay was still bad, but the novelty of it being a bunch of robots was funny. So I might keep that one around, but generally they play incredibly badly. So it's given that you get like 700 of them per like console, I'm gonna go through and get rid of those and hopefully make enough space for a couple more PlayStation games.
Cool. Do you reckon you can get Final Fantasy 7 on there? That's probably the only one that has like a large file size, right? The rest are all probably like 2 megabytes.
Well, PlayStation games generally come in at around 500 meg.
Really wouldn't know it from looking at the blockiness of Crash Bandicoot.
Well, it's all to do with the music. Because it's the first generation to really have high quality music instead of just bleep bloop blap bloop bleep. That was the official soundtrack to Sonic 3, by the way.
By Michael Jackson.
By Michael Jackson.
His best work. Bleep blap bloop.
Yep, definitely his best work. But I think because of it was the first era to really use that high quality sound, it actually means that the file sizes are much bigger. And also there was a big jump in graphical quality in terms of the sheer amount of file needed to render things. So so they are a bit bigger. I'm sure this is very riveting for our audience, by the way.
Welcome to the file size podcast.
Welcome to the PlayStation file size podcast.
Some nerd out there is having the time of his life.
Speaking of nerds, Ruby Sparks has a big nerd in it.
Good pivot.
He's the mega nerd. He's the kind of nerd who even I would like push into the lockers and go, "What's up, dweeb?
Yeah, give me your lunch money.
Give me your lunch money, dork."
He wrote a novel called, what is it even called?
It's called
They Sad, never say what it's about.
It's called Sad White Man. It's about a sad white man.
It's called Sad Boy. He dropped out of high school and he wrote a novel. No one who drops out of high school writes a novel.
That's the most unrealistic thing about this. Not the fact that sad white boy imagined perfect manic pixie dream girl.
Then she appears.
The most unrealistic thing is that he dropped out of high school and he didn't just then spend years smoking pot and working in a diner.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm sorry, lad. Why do you not skateboard? But Ruby Sparks, right?
Yeah. I have a feeling you're about to go off on one. Last time we recorded, you were grumpy. And you were like, oh, let's watch Ruby Sparks. I'm probably going to be grumpy about it. Are you about to be grumpy about it?
Well, I'm not going to be entirely grumpy about it because my opinion on the film hasn't changed since I first saw it. And this is only my second time watching it. And the same thing happened again this time where... I started off despising the characters, and then about 15 minutes in, I realized, wait, I'm supposed to despise this character. And then at the end of the movie, the saccharin ending makes me really angry again. So I still feel like this is such a good film until like the last 10 minutes.
Yeah, the ending really stinks. it's just that, yeah, he then sees her again.
Hello,
in the
are you
park
there?
And it's, can you hear
You've
me
started
now?
Tronning all over the place.
Oh, no. Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? I can hear you now. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now.
Okay, good. Let's carry it on. Okay. Could you hear me the whole time then? Oh, I just stopped. I was going, can you hear me now? Can you hear me now?
I could only hear you towards the end of when you were going, can you hear me now? Yeah. Right. So
when you just as an aside on that, when you have a child, you have to make everything into a song. So I'm just inclined every time there's anything that you need to say, it just becomes a song.
See, I already do that for the cat, so I think I'm going to transition well into parenthood.
Yeah, you're well prepared, I think.
So
little cat, you are so furry and angry, little cat.
I mean, the one thing that I will have to do is stop the swearing in the song, where I generally just swear sing at the cat, calling her a what's and what and so. So where did we get up to?
We were talking about the ending. I hate the ending so much, and it really does. I wouldn't say that it ruins the film, but it's not good. Because it's like he sees her at the end, the girl that he wrote and then decided they couldn't be with, because the whole point is that you can't magic people into thin air and you can't live on imagination alone, and that kind of the perfection that you can, that you would try to write in a relationship, doesn't exist, and all that kind of stuff, which is the point of it. It's then, and then he sees her in the park again and she's reading his book about her. It's just really weird and nonsensical, and it's like, what are you supposed to take from that he did it all just to read a book so he could meet her, to write a book so he could meet her again? It's really, I don't know what to make of the ending, honestly.
What annoys me is this movie would be one of my favourite films if it ended with him having banged the keyboard and then she's lying on the ground. And I think that would have been an incredible, impactful ending, because it is, this movie, up until the last 15 minutes, last 10, 15 minutes, I think is one of the best critiques of what romance is written like in cinema, and one of the best critiques of the nice guy syndrome, where the main character in this film, he is an awful human being, in the same way that Scott Pilgrim is an awful human being. Where he is,
he's a lovable oaf.
He treats people terribly. He is awful to his family and to his friends. He has
terrible at bass guitar.
He has this he has this sense of self-importance about his place in the world as well. And there's this whole thing about him, not wanting to be called a genius. And then that all falls away at the end, where he's asking her to call him a genius. And that veneer of, I'm a humble, nice guy, is just eradicated. And it's a really powerful moment where you can see that actually all he wants is power, and all he wants is power over another person. And he is this controlling individual. But then at the end, it's like, oh, well, he's got his life back on track now, and he's started being a good person again, and he's written a book and he's feeling better. And so now he is rewarded with having his dream girl again. And it's like, no, that's a really bad message to send here, because people don't change that much. And yes, I get that you wanted to have a nice ending and a happy ending to your film. But if you really wanted to send a strong message, you should have kept it with, this guy is a bad guy. This guy, because he didn't get what he wanted, he decided to destroy the woman that he supposedly loves, way of life.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's like, by vindicating him after he's been so awful as to, become sort of really drunk with power and have this kind of mad scene where it almost crosses over into horror, and you're like, oh, this is actually really disconcerting, but in a good way. Then, it totally vindicates him and makes all of that, it seemed like the film wants you to think that all of that's okay, that he did that, and that he was, that's just what a genius is like, and that kind of thing. It conforms to the genius myth and a sort of myth of romance being about power, if that makes sense. It's really odd.
Yeah, because it does such a good job of undermining your feelings about the main character all the way through. So for a bit of backstory for anyone who hasn't seen it yet, Paul Dano is, he's Paul Dano. That's his character.
Paul Dano
name.
Is Paul Dano.
he is a young writing prodigy. He wrote this incredible book at the age of 19 that has become this cult classic, this favorite American novel. But in the last 10 years or so, he has struggled to write a second book, and he's written things like novellas and short story collections and things like that. But he's struggling to do that. And on top of that, he's finding it difficult to meet people, which he's not really doing anything about apart from having bought a dog, which he then resents.
A cute dog.
Very cute dog, a lovely border terrier. This film gets high marks on dog content. Dog content, it's great. So then he gets told by his shrink to write about meeting someone who accepts the dog the way they are.
The shrink, who honestly, I know it's Elliot Gould, but the first time I saw him, I thought it was George Lucas. Looks so much like George.
Write about an alien who accepts your dog the way it is. And so he writes about this woman, and it's the same woman that he's already seen in his dreams. And
Jar Jar Binks.
But then it just so happens that by writing about her this time, and it's never explained why, which I like, you know, is it a magic typewriter? Is it some kind of tulpa situation where his frustration has created something manifest in the real world? It's never really explained, and I like it that way. But
yeah, that's not the point of it at all.
No, exactly. But the next day he wakes up, and then there she is, Ruby Sparks, played by Zoe Kazan, who also wrote the film.
Yeah, that's what's really interesting about it, isn't it, that she wrote it?
Yes. Yeah. And and she is this dream girl that he's wanted, and it initially plays like the trope of the manic pixie dream girl, which we've seen in many movies.
I believe she rejects.
Exactly. The whole thing is undermining and rejecting that concept, where initially everything seems rosy, but then, you know, it's clear that Paul Dano's character does not understand how to be in a relationship with someone else and doesn't understand how to look after somebody else. And how to respect somebody else, and this leads to issues along the way, and it drip feeds you the issues with his character. So it starts off with him being a bit awkward about her going out and getting a job or joining a class, that kind of thing, and you think, oh, that's a bit weird, why is he being so controlling over her? Then not wanting to present her in front of his family. And you think initially, oh, this might be a issue with the fact that he created her out of thin air. But actually, that's not the issue here. The issue is it's controlling who she meets and controlling her relationship with his relationships, as it were. And you know, never trust a guy who doesn't like Antonio Banderas. I think that's a pretty, that's a pretty big rule for life, is if someone doesn't like Antonio Banderas, then you know there's something wrong with them.
Especially when he's being so nice and giving them a nice chair, which they have to hilariously put in the back of their car.
Yeah, exactly. So you get these warning signs of, oh, he's being really, he's rejecting the company of his own family. For no real good reason either. And over time, you get to recognize he's actually a very quite nasty person, quite controlling person. And it all comes to a head at a party that Steve Coogan's character, his kind of mentor figure, is throwing.
Langdon Tharp.
Mike Truck.
That's totally a Bobson Dugnut name.
where he meets up with his ex-girlfriend, who all he's called her before in this movie is a slut, and that's it, and that's the only thing you know, is she was mean to me, she is a slut, and that's his frame of reference for her. And then it becomes quite clear that actually, again, he was very unsupportive and very controlling and was not emotionally available to her at all. And you think, well, actually, yes, this whole person's frame of reference, Paul Dano's whole frame of reference, is a lie. He is a wonderful, unreliable narrator in this situation. And amongst all of these other male figures, so his very much more masculine brother, or Antonio Banderas or Steve Coogan, all of which have issues apart from Antonio Banderas, who is wonderful.
He's the loveliest possible stepdad figure.
But the rest of the characters in this movie, they all portray different areas of toxic masculinity, I suppose. So the brother in general is much more realistic and much more grounded, and I think has a much more natural and positive relationship with other people, including his family. But again, he kind of at times reverts back to focusing on the physical of women. But he's probably the least nasty male character in this. So Steve Coogan is then a very predatory older male using his position of power. And then you've got the nice guy, Paul Dano, who at first seems like a timid and generally meek, nice individual, but actually is possibly the most dangerous of the lot, because at the end of the movie, it ends with him abusing her.
He shows his true colours.
Yes, and there's no other way to describe it. He is using his magic typewriter or whatever to basically cause her to be unable to leave the house, to be unable to communicate, to only communicate in the way that he so chooses.
And the gradual creep towards that scene does work quite well. I think it's very, very well paced, where as soon as he's like, oh, I'm never going to, like, initially he's like, okay, she's here, I'm not going to write about her again because I don't want to control her because she's here, and it works. But as soon as it's like, it's not working for him and it's not exactly like his fantasy, then yeah, he starts writing her again and starts trying to control her, and he is extremely controlling, and there are hints of her noticing it as well. And that's what is clever about it, is that it's like, even though he's controlling her, she is aware of it, even though she is his fantasy. So it does then sort of gradually, through that good plot and that good pace, reveal the how would I put it, it reveals that you know you can't make love out of just your own fantasy, can you? That it's a two-way street is the point.
Exactly, yeah. And you put it quite succinctly. The moment things start going wrong for him, he decides to change her. And that's the whole method of this movie, is whenever there is something wrong in his relationship with someone else, it's never down to him and he never changes. He just goes and writes something new about her. So it might be that she never wants to leave his side.
Exactly, and that's why the ending is so problematic, because it's like it's endorsing all of that. It's like, oh yeah, that being kind of a power-hungry, crazed fantasist and never understanding that, you know, love is something that is shared between two people, and that, you know, what romance is, it's just there.
Yeah, you know, it's all right that he was a horrible, controlling, abusive, nasty creep, because, hey, a bit of time's passed now and he's released a book in the meantime. It's like, no.
Yeah. It's horrendous. It's okay because he's a cool, famous author.
Yeah, it's so the end of this movie is a real downer for me. I remember thinking that at the time.
To keep banging on about the ending, because there are a lot of things about it to like, but it does, yeah, as you say, put a downer on it.
It kind of spoils what was powerful about the film in the first place, which I think is the biggest shame. But in terms of positives, let's talk about positives then. The key breakdown of love story tropes in this movie is one of the most effective I've ever seen, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
It's the way that it sort of frames everything, the way that it pulls the rag out from under you, where you think you're watching a certain kind of film, and then it becomes steadily apparent that actually it's very much almost a meta movie about love movies and about romantic movies.
It's very ambitious in that sense, isn't it? It's a film that really has ambition conceptually and in the way that it tries to portray things, in its characterization, in the way that it pulls it all together. And, you know, the fact that it's let down by, you know, a Hollywood ending, I suppose, that they probably felt they had to do, doesn't take away from the ambition of it, which is something to appreciate.
Yes, yeah, exactly. There's definitely a lot of quality here. And I think Zoe Kazan's writing in general is really good. The dialogue, the way that the scenes are framed, a lot of care and attention went into writing this film. And I don't know what happened behind the scenes, if there was a sort of push towards giving it a happy ending. I'm not sure whether it would do, because everyone involved in this has always been quite careful about doing things on their own terms.
Yeah.
So I don't know, but I personally feel as though giving it a horrible ending, and hey, what a surprise, Rob wants a really depressing, horrible ending to a movie.
Yeah, she should have died.
She should have fucking died, and then Paul Dano should have fucking shot his dog and then gone on a rampage. screaming, "I am the Dano now.
tell me I'm a genius.
Tell me I'm a genius." But I do think that, yeah, giving it that really nasty ending would have worked so well. But apart from, the writing's great. The message is really good. The performances are brilliant as well. I think everyone in this film works fantastically within their own framing here.
Yeah, I agree. They're all very, very good people. Paul Dano, obviously, as we know, is someone that we really, really like.
Yes, yeah. And
I can't think of anything I don't like him in.
And he's great in this. I think he kind of shows off how it's almost like the perfect example of someone being able to put those nastier elements into a performance over the course of time. So what initially appears to be a pathetic and empathetic and likable character, he again slowly manages to show, just with like the odd sideways glance and just the odd moment here and there, how dangerous this person potentially could be. And so, you know, I'm not sure whether this is my favorite performance of his, but I think it might be, actually. I think
it's definitely up there, for sure.
I think he shows a real great variety here.
He doesn't drink any milkshake.
He does not drink any milkshake. But, you know, I think this movie kind of, it showed how much extra he could do. And, you know, he was in movies like Prisoners after this, which is a phenomenal movie. And, of course, Swiss Army Man, where he basically, you know, although, you know, Daniel Radcliffe is great in that film as well, he is the active participant in that movie.
Yeah, that's a film. Yeah, if you didn't listen to us talking about that film, that's a very interesting episode. And it's a film that, yeah, I think I do really, really love, even though it's really, really odd and strange and horrible. But yeah, his performance in that is really something.
Yeah, exactly. And again, it's a similar kind of thing, isn't it? Where he appears as this sympathetic character, but actually then deep down there's something much nastier going on with him. And so he's really good at portraying those kind of characters. And it's something I'd like to see more of him doing as well going forwards. So here he's Calvin. There's no Hobbes. I think maybe it should have been Ruby Hobbes, and then we could have had a Calvin and Hobbes situation.
Yep. And she's like a little tiny.
But I do wonder if that was a reference to Calvin and Hobbes, calling him Calvin with an imaginary friend.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. Yeah. And no one else can hear Hobbes. They just see him as the stuffed tiger. So really, what she should have been was like a taxidermied woman. And then he's like, "Don't you see? Don't you see? She's talking. She's moving." And they're like, "Why have you?
Why have you stuffed a corpse in your house?"
Yeah.
But
the creepiness of his character, you know, you'd believe it.
Well, exactly.
Seen actually, how the darker side of him. You'd believe that he could do something like
exactly,
that.
Exactly. So yeah, he's brilliant in this. Zoe Kazan as well is really good. And, you know, I'm a huge fan of hers. I don't think I've seen anything where I haven't thought her performance is excellent.
Yeah, for sure.
And this is a perfect example of that. Where again, what you first think of as being this kind of typical character is completely undermined, and there is a complexity to her performance which is brilliant. And the further it goes on, and what's also great is the way that there's this physicality to her performance. When he has changed her personality by writing about it, you can physically see the change in her after each sort of addition or subtraction being made to her character.
Yeah, for sure.
Which is great.
It's just great. And it's an acting challenge as well to do something like that where you're being controlled, especially that one sort of horrible scene where he's writing her and she has to do, she's like singing and jumping around and she has to pretend that she like can't get out of the room and stuff. It's actually very unsettling, and she does that very well.
Yeah, so again, a brilliant performance. But then you've got, you know, Chris Messina as the brother. Really good. You know,
he's great. I think he's really underrated.
He is, definitely. And this, again, is a great performance from him. You know,
have you ever seen the film The Giant Mechanical Man?
I have not, no.
He's kind of the lead guy in that, and it's him and Jenna Fischer, aka Pam from The Office. And I think it's I don't know that it's amazing, but it's a film that I really liked, and he was in it. It's quite an interesting film. We should talk about that at some point.
Oh, cool. Okay. Yeah, we'll do. I think I'll have to check that out and see it.
Yeah, but I like him a lot.
Yeah, and he's been in loads of great films, hasn't he? And loads of great
films. He was in Away We Go. Yeah. This is the friend.
In the newsroom, the Aaron Sorkin thing about how news is made. It's the news.
This is the news.
This is the news.
I never saw that.
It was all right. It was no West Wing. And again, there was lots of things in it which were clearly inaccurate. But it was still kind of enjoyable schmaltzy guff, effectively. but in a good way.
Sorkin guff is still
good. Exactly. And then, you know, Antonio Banderas and Annette Bening. Brilliant.
Yeah, very good. Really good pairing of those two as well. I mean, they've had very little screen time, but I thought they really, really worked as the parents who he was like... And again, the fact that he's sort of embarrassed by his mum and partner, who are clearly really, really lovely and have this really nice house and just want like the best for him. It's, yeah, that's a really, really good, again, kind of slow burn on the fact that he's actually a total fuck up.
Yes, yeah. It's really interesting the way that they're framed and how loving they are. And you get these hints that she was a very different person before, but she seems like such a happy person there. And then a tour de force performance from Antonio Banderas as the stepdad character, where he just kind of steals the scene for the brief moments that he's in it. He's just got this joy and this energy to him. And he pretends to be a dog, which, you know, everyone wants to see.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. And then later on, Zoe Kazan has to pretend to be a dog as well.
Yes.
She does lots of barking and running around.
Yeah. You know, everything's a circle. It all comes back to dog personification.
The dog circle. Caninification.
That'll do.
Yep. Not to be confused with canonification, which is a religious.
Precisely.
Thing. Which is when you baptize a dog. if you want your dog to go to heaven,
you've got to baptize it.
You know that film, All Dogs Go to Heaven. Bullshit. If your dog hasn't been baptized, it ain't getting it.
Precisely. So. Again, yeah, performances are great. And the direction as well is really good. It's a very pretty movie. Directed by the duo Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris, who have done, you know, they did Little Miss Sunshine, which is an amazing film. They did Battle of the Sexes, which I've not seen, but I've heard is good. Which is the one...
I have not either, yeah.
Which is the tennis.
Emma Stone and Steve Carell.
Yep, so that's the...
It looks very good.
Looks really good, and apparently it's good as well. But apart from that, they've directed some of the best music videos ever.
Oh, yeah?
Yep, so Smashing Pumpkins, Tonight, that was them.
Ah, I love that video.
Korn, Freak on a Leash, that was them.
Oh, right, the one with the bullet.
The one with the bullet, yeah, amazing.
The bullet comes into the room, and suddenly he's like...
Exactly. But like the way that video, I think, kind of, it's part of what propelled Korn to stardom, really, because of the way that,
absolutely,
you know, you've got this slow motion bullet going through things like apples and cartons of milk and things like that. And it's a genuinely really pretty video for a very strange song that perhaps might not have found an audience otherwise if there hadn't been that to it.
Yeah. Korn were just an awful band, weren't they?
Well, what
are they still around?
I think they're still around. I'm not sure if they've got all their original members. What I find interesting about Korn is that when they were weird, they were really interesting, but then they got slowly less and less weird from their heyday, and so they were pretty awful. But like, they had a singer who couldn't really sing very well. And then this really strange setup of like a slap bass guitarist and then Fieldy.
I love Fieldy so much. I just for the fact that he released a hip hop album called Fieldy's Dreams.
I know, it's so good.
So good.
And so they're a really strange band, Korn, and it's the kind of band that I don't think could ever make it big nowadays, because weirdness like that never gets big. Bands like them or System of a Down,
System of a Down, I think, are a bit easier on the ears, aren't they? But some of their stuff is quite melodic.
But I think just in terms of the strangeness of
political messages and stuff, I think they're easier to swallow.
But I think the strangeness of their setup, so they're all of their weird, you know, like rhythm sections and things like that, and the way that Serge Tankian sings is quite unique. I think if they suddenly appeared today, they would never be anywhere near as big as they were now. as they were back in the day. And I think Korn kind of would have the same thing, where they were a weird band with a weird setup of like slap bass, down-tuned guitars, scatting, bagpipes.
Seven strings, yeah. I love that on the Wikipedia page, Jonathan Davis, lead vocals, bagpipe.
Exactly. And at their weirdest, I think there was something interesting about them. More interesting than bands like Slipknot or Mushroom Head. bring up the classic.
On, Slipknot wore masks.
That makes up for atonal dirge music.
I think Slipknot, once they got a few albums in, actually started to make some relatively melodic stuff.
They did that one really good song that everyone loves. Duality. Yeah, Duality is a great song.
That is a banger.
Yeah.
It slaps.
It slaps. It does not slap bass.
No.
But in general, Slipknot, I think, were pretty boring. And I think at least Korn early on had some weird stuff going on, like the weird scatting, like the bagpipes. I wouldn't necessarily say that it's good, but at least it was doing something unique.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, bad music. New metal. It all comes back to new metal, doesn't it?
The new metal circle.
But a bad, strange, interesting time in popular music.
Very bad. How did we get onto
Korn? I haven't. Their direction.
They directed the video, right.
Yeah. So they also did, I know you love the Red Hot Chili Peppers Californication. They directed that, and they directed...
Actually, that is a good video.
Yeah, yeah.
It goes through all the like background sets of... it's like going through Hollywood film sets and stuff, isn't it?
Precisely, yeah. And I think they did Say It Ain't So by Weezer.
Really?
Yeah. They did a Weezer video. I'm not sure which one, but I think it was Say It Ain't So. So they've done loads of brilliant videos over the years. And so, you know, and then they moved from that to, you know, making great movies. And I think this is, in general, it's a really good film. It's just a shame about that ending. It really is.
Yeah. It looks great. And all of the locations are really well chosen, even down to his house, which actually I think looks exactly like the kind of house that a writer living in LA would live in, weirdly. It's got that pool and it's not massive and he hasn't splashed out, but it is still very, very nice, you know, and it also works well for all the different various shots that they need to do. It's just great.
It's a real BoJack Horseman house.
Yes, it is.
Like a real kind of soulless but clinical place. And so then you get that real comparison piece, that contrast with his parents' house, where there's so much unique stuff going on there. There's this chaos to it, whereas his own life is very much clinical. And then Ruby's character is much more in the realm of the chaos. Just in terms of its setting and its mise-en-scene, you've got that real clash going on. So it's a very well thought out film as well.
Yeah.
So there's so much here to recommend.
There really is. Yeah. If you haven't seen it, it's definitely like well worth watching for sure. It's interesting on a number of levels. Just, yeah, it's a slightly irritating and problematic ending.
Yeah. I don't like the ending.
He should have just like, or even it would have worked even if it wasn't her, even if it was some other girl who was reading his book. And you're like, okay, that's a little bit cheesy and a bit giving himself a pat on the back for writing a book about this, but it's not his dream girl. It's someone else and it's going to be new and different and it's going to move forward. That's kind of what you really want it to be, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that he's deserved happiness. to be quite brutal, I don't think it. I don't think he's.
You don't think he deserves a chance to try again?
I think he deserves a chance to try again, but I think given what we've seen him just
to rehabilitate himself.
Yeah, given what we've seen him just do, I think throwing him back into a romantic relationship, it kind of just shows that there is no ramifications for his actions.
So how would you like him to atone for his actions?
I'd like him to just die. That's what I want.
So at the end, after he shot his dog, he turns the gun on himself.
Precisely. Or just it ends with some kind of awkward autoerotic asphyxiation. And then, you know, like his brother walking in and going, oh, for God's sake, Calvin.
Yeah, here we go again.
Here we go again.
And then his brother says something, yeah, something misogynist. He uses the word poon. Everyone laughs.
Suddenly the first example of a laughter track in the movie. And then it ends. Yeah, no, I don't know. Yeah. I don't feel as though, because what he does at the end is one of, it's really distressing to watch, the way that he treats Ruby. And it,
yeah, and the film wants you to be distressed.
Yes, and it wants it to be. It does want you to feel uncomfortable watching it. But then the fact that it then turns around and allows him, and I'm not sure whether a second chance for him so soon after these events would really feel right, because you know he doesn't he had absolute control over Ruby. What's he going to do when he doesn't have absolute control over someone?
Yeah. I guess if you want to feel like he's going to atone for it, you actually need more detail, don't you? You need a whole kind of part two film where he proves to himself that he can love another person properly.
Yeah, because all he's done in Ruby Sparks at the end is write a book and let the woman who he kept captive in his house get away. That's all he's done.
Yeah.
Which I don't necessarily think that it warrants him getting a second chance. It's the kind of example of the big Hollywood love gesture, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I wrote this book for you on my typewriter.
Yeah, it's written on a typewriter, so it means it's more lovely. It's more artistic. Yeah.
But I do like it when the typewriter words come up on the screen, though. I'm
yeah.
The typewriter, putting them in. I like that.
Yeah, it's very pretty, but typewriters are slow and...
impractical.
Yeah. Get a fucking computer like everyone else.
Yeah. Yeah, why didn't they show him just like working in cafes on his MacBook or whatever?
And just occasionally just shouting, I'm writing a novel.
Yeah. I'm a genius. Tell me I'm a genius.
I'm a genius.
Yeah, it should have been just at least half an hour of him going around LA shaking people and going, tell me I'm a genius.
Yeah, exactly.
Because that's what his personality is really like.
Yeah, precisely. He wants that kind of glory. And that's what it's about. And he's finding it difficult to write the second book because he wants that glory again. He wants that adoration that he had the first time around. It's not about being a perfectionist writer who really wants to write something important.
It's about the fact that men are awful pigs.
Exactly.
This is what men do if you give them a typewriter and things that come to life.
Exactly. Exactly. Like
pigs with typewriters.
If I had a magic typewriter... I don't know what I'd do with it. I'd probably just be like, Rob was suddenly super buff. Oh, look at that. I'm super buff. Great. Rob had 5 pizzas. Oh, yeah. 5 pizzas. Rob had 50 million pounds. Oh, look at that. And then I'd probably be like, oh, I'm kind of set now.
Yeah. And I'd be like, Paddy called up Theresa May and got her to stop Brexit.
Yeah.
And then there was no Brexit.
But
I'd use my powers for good.
I would use mine a little bit for good.
But I genuinely would, as you say, get buff first.
Yeah. I mean,
because I really struggle with my weight my whole life. It's the thing I want to change the most instantly and easily.
Because
it's the one thing that you can't change easily. You know?
Yeah, precisely.
Thing, you have to put in a lot of very tedious work into it.
Yeah. And
it's like playing Toca Touring Cars 2 for hours a day.
If I could lose weight by playing Toca Touring Cars 2, I would be The Rock.
Yeah, well, it's strength training of a different kind.
Exactly.
Strengthens the mind against utter boredom.
It's helped me become the well-rounded man that I am today.
Your capacity for pure tedium is like nothing I've ever seen.
But I think it's interesting that there's this typewriter and it's allowed him to become a monster. But what would he have been if he didn't have that outlet? Would he have become a monster in other ways?
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like if a thing brings out the worst in someone, are they still a bad person because that was always there beneath the surface? Or if you'd never have known that it was there and they just went through their life without it ever being revealed, it would have been fine, right?
Yeah, exactly. Or would he have, you know, when he gets into another relationship, will he again be controlling? And you imagine that he probably would be.
Which is the implication of the film, for sure.
Mm, exactly. So,
because when he talks to his ex-girlfriend, that's implied there as well.
Yeah, because he's horrible to her. And it's clear that he was horrible to her. So, yeah, he's a bad man. He is
a roadman.
He is a bad human being, and I do not feel bad for him. And I want to rescue his dog and then give him a noogie and give him a swirly and call him a dork.
Yeah, give him a wedgie. Wait, no, wait, what's a swirly?
Wait, what is a swirly?
Is that what you... Have you just made that up?
No, I've heard it. American.
Is that when you put their face in the toilet and flush it?
Maybe.
American listeners who were bullied in high school, please get in touch and let us know.
Let's find out what a swirly is.
Were you swirlied?
A swirly is the process of sticking someone's head in the toilet and flushing. There we go.
I was right.
You were right. Well, I'd give him a swirly.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
I'd give him a noogie.
Swirly, noogie, wedgie. What else is there? Chinese burns.
Yep.
Is that a problematic phrase?
Almost certainly. Yeah. It's got to be. What are the other things you can give people?
A kiss?
He would not get a kiss.
No, not from you.
He will not feel my lips.
Give him a kick up the bum.
Give him a kick up the bum.
And then push him in the pool.
He would get bundled as well. Was there bundling? Was there bundling at your school?
Yeah, yeah. The bundle was responsible for my only visit to the hospital.
Oh, really?
Between the ages of 0 and 18. Oh, well, really, one time as a kid, I think I banged my head. But yeah, I got bundled on and broke my arm.
I got bundled and I hurt my knee, and that's why my knee clicks to this day.
Oh. Bundling sets you up for life.
Yeah. Bundling or took a tour in cars too? What's more dangerous?
Oh, God, I'd rather be bundled on, honestly. So now that I'm an adult large man, I reckon I could handle it.
I don't know. If it was other adult men, I think there would be the potential for much worse.
That's true, actually, yeah. If it was a group of, 10 adult men down the pub.
Yep, exactly.
Bundling competition in the beer garden.
Oh, mate, that'd be the worst.
Yeah. Or it's like a secret bundling syndicate.
Fight Club.
Like cockfights.
Oh, okay.
Which I mean, like chickens, not penises.
But what we're saying here is that Paul Dano would get attacked by chickens or bundled or given a swirly. Yeah. And it would
definitely.
It would be entirely warranted. Not the real Paul Dano. Not Paul Dano in real life. I do mean his character in this film.
Who is called Paul Dano?
Who is called Paul Calvin Dano.
Paul K. Dano.
Paul K. Dano.
No, in real life, I think he's obviously an extremely nice man.
Yeah, I bet he's a lovely fella. Yeah. I bet he would appreciate Toka touring cars too.
He would. He would be so into it. He'd just sit down with you and you'd be explaining to him all the boring settings and how to change gear, and he would listen so intently.
Yeah, and then we'd play a whole championship together.
He'd be like, please tell me more, Rob.
Yeah, he'd be loving it. We'd be getting 1-2s around Silverstone, Brands Hatch.
Brands Hatch.
Brands Hatch, the greatest circuit in all the land. Do you want the glamour of Monaco or Brands Hatch?
Yeah, Paul Dano's like, I've never even been to Monaco. Monaco's rubbish.
Exactly. But
tell me more about the history of Brands Hatch.
He loves
please.
Going to Brands Hatch and watching like touring cars.
Yeah, it's his favourite.
Oh.
The thing is, he doesn't really, but because he knows that you like it, he's really patient with you.
But then he gets to love it because all good people love Toka touring cars.
Does that mean I'm a bad man?
Yeah, I'd give you a swirly.
Would you?
Yeah.
Would you push me into a ring to fight a chicken?
I would.
And I assume how illegal cockfighting was. <I'd>... Man versus chicken.
Cover you in breadcrumbs, throw you into an arena with some chickens.
Oh, multiple chickens.
Yeah, it's not just one chicken. It's you weigh the person and then you and you weigh the chickens.
So you have to fight your approximate weight in chickens.
Exactly, that's how it works. That's where
I wonder how close they can get with, like, they've got some large chickens, and then to get it really accurate, they've just got like a box full of bantams. Like, you know, those tiny angry chickens.
Yeah, exactly.
Pull them out. Get me another bantam, Steve.
That's where the terms featherweight and bantam weight come from.
Oh right, yeah, of course.
It's all from illegal chicken fights.
Yeah. If you've ever seen an illegal chicken fight, we want to hear from you.
Yeah.
In fact, I want to now write a film about a romance across the lines of an illegal chicken fight.
Oh, amazing.
You know, you could easily like just port the Romeo and Juliet plot, couldn't you? There's one side the Montagues and the Chiculets or whatever, and different two sides of the warring chicken syndicate.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Anyway, right, do you have anything else to say about Ruby Sparks?
No, it is good generally, and yeah, the ending's kind of annoying, but it's a very, very interesting and enjoyable film. And yeah, it's entertaining for sure, is the other thing. It's enjoyable to watch, and it is funny as well. There are some scenes that are quite enjoyable to watch. The dialogue generally is pretty sharp, so overall it's entertaining and it's enjoyable. But yeah, it's very, very ambitious and gets 85% of the way there, I'd say, in trying to provide a huge philosophical statement about how romance is written, which is still a very, very good feat, I would say.
Yes, I think that is... It nearly gets there, doesn't it? It nearly gets there to becoming a real classic of the introspective meta film. But the ending does kind of undermine it a little bit.
But at least it manages to be an introspective meta film without being pretentious, which is good.
Yes, yeah, for sure.
So that is a good thing.
It is, it is. And I'd recommend do watch it.
Absolutely.
Because you might find the ending less annoying than we did, in which case you're in for a treat, because the rest of the film is fantastic.
Yeah, good times.
So I've got some trivia.
Yep.
So Paul Dano and Zoe Kazan are a couple in real life. But also, did you...
I knew that.
Also, did you know that both of them have kissed Daniel Radcliffe?
Oh, yes, because she's in that film, What If, with him.
And then Paul Dano is in Swiss Army Man.
Yes.
So they have both kissed Daniel Radcliffe.
Yeah. Has she heard Daniel Radcliffe fart a lot,
though? I don't know, maybe. Behind the scenes in that film, possibly.
Yeah. Or seen him use his boner to propel himself across the land. Whatever other disgusting stuff happened in that film.
Oh, that is a strange movie, isn't it?
Yeah. I kind of feel like I need to watch it again.
Yeah, I kind of want to watch it again as well.
Yeah, which would be the third time I've seen it. But it's great.
Apart from that, Scotty rips up a book. The book is a copy of The Catcher in the Rye by J.D. Salinger.
Ah, I thought he meant like he rips up the phone book, you know, and he'd like tear a phone book in half. He's a strong dog.
Power dog. Obviously, there's a few references to Catcher in the Rye in this movie. The famous novel about the man who catches a hell of a lot of rye. Yep. He's just out there grabbing all the rye he can.
He's like, give me all that rye. I want it all.
It's like,
now.
If I can't grab all this rye, then I'm a phony. That kind of thing.
Yep.
That's what Catcher in the Rye is about, right?
It's all about that rye.
All about that rye. All about that catching.
Right. Yeah. And then he makes sandwiches and throws them out for people to catch. So then they become the catchers of the rye.
Yeah, which was the sequel, which never got released.
Yeah, because Salinger went mad and hid in his basement
the,
or whatever.
The lost great American novel.
Yeah. As an aside, I do genuinely really like Salinger's work, even though he was, reclusive and strange. I actually like some of his other work better than The Catcher in the Rye.
So I think I've only read The Catcher in the Rye, but it feels that it feels that kind of nihilistic place that American Psycho and Fight Club have with me, where I really enjoy the way that it acts as a deconstruction. What other books are like that? Like Less Than Zero. By Bret Easton Ellis is another one, and
Bullet Park.
Fast Lights, Big City, is that what it's called? Bright Lights, Big City, something like that. That's another one that's really good like that. And then Bullet Park, those kind of things I really enjoy. So Catcher in the Rye, I mean, it could have done with more catching in the rye, I think.
Yeah, not enough rye.
Not enough rye. I wanted more rye.
Not enough catching, not enough
I
rye.
I want a copy of that book printed on rye bread so I can... read a
you can eat it.
Yeah, I read a page and then I eat, you know.
It's the ideal scenario. The kind of the two best things in life, eating and reading.
The kind of
why would you not want to combine
them? I want that kind of interactive media that kind of cross-media interpretation. Give it to me.
This is the future.
Anyway, right, that'll do for trivia, I think. I've sort of diverted myself enough of all this Rye talk.
That's great.
Yeah.
And I like that it has French songs in it as well. That one French song when they're dancing, that's quite
fun. Oh, yeah, What's It called?
Yeah. Ça plane pour moi.
By Crazy Bertrand, is it something like that?
Plastic Bertrand.
Crazy Bertrand.
You know, I'm a mate, Crazy Bertrand. He's crazy.
I think
that's like someone who's like the guy who gets invited on the stag night who nobody else knows, and it's like, and then he turns up and raises hell.
He's like, oh, you know, let's
crazy,
get in the
crazy
shots.
Bertrand. It's my mate from school, Crazy Bertrand.
Yeah. Alternatively, he's the guy who owns the second-hand car dealership. Welcome to Crazy Bertrand's second-hand BMWs.
He's like Swiss Tony. But actually French.
Exactly. It's good. I like it.
So it's good. How shall we rate it?
Ah, that's a tough one. How many beautiful wooden chairs from Antonio Banderas would you take home?
Oh, all of them, obviously. As many as I could fit into my very large car. I suppose my car could probably fit 13 chairs.
Yeah, that sounds
that sounds about right.
That sounds like a good number of chairs. I think I'm going to go for 13 as well, actually. I think we're on the same page here, where this movie could have been a great, but it's not, partly because of the ending. And it does kind of undermine the rest of the message.
But still very enjoyable, entertaining, fun, and unique. So we'll give it that.
Yeah, for sure.
Nice. So next up is my choice, or in fact my wife's choice. She wanted us to watch this film Gifted from 2017, starring Chris Evans, not that one, about a man with a gifted child, and there's a romance with a teacher and stuff. But she insists that I've seen it, and I haven't. So either I was there and I fell asleep or something, but yeah. There it is.
Just so you know, the next episode I'm going to be singing Lifted by the Lighthouse Family, apart from Gifted, for a good 20% of it.
Can't remember how that song goes.
They say the word lifted a lot.
Right.
And then there's some nice easy listening music.
See, I remember the Lighthouse Family being a name that was everywhere in the 90s, but I couldn't genuinely tell you a single note of their music.
I'll send you a link.
I'm sure I'd recognize it if I heard it.
Yeah, I'll send you a link to the Lighthouse Family. The greatest...
Easy listening.
The greatest band in the world.
Now, were they a family who lived in a lighthouse, or is their surname Lighthouse? Hi, I'm John Lighthouse.
I think it was that they lived in a very lighthouse. It was made out of balloons.
Oh, okay. That doesn't sound very good for the weather.
No, exactly. It's why they didn't last long beyond the 90s.
Yeah. they've since moved into a regular house and have moved on to other careers.
Now they're the Brick House family.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Anything else to share?
No. I'm off to go to a cockfighting ring in the local pub.
Good. I hope you get some nice chickens that aren't aggressive.
Yeah. Did you see, that's the thing. Not all chickens are aggressive. Some are and some aren't. Although they try their best to find the most aggressive chickens they can. It's not a guarantee.
Precisely.
You might get some that are quite nice.
Yeah, exactly. You might get some that are quite placid.
You feel bad for fighting them. Yeah.
Right, okay then. Right.
All right. So, yeah, we'll be back next week to talk about Gifted. If you want to get in touch with us, you always can on the Twitter at BigBoysDon'tPod, on the email BigBoysDon'tCryPodcast@gmail.com. What do you think of the ending of Ruby Sparks? Do you care or not? Or are you just like, yeah, let the man have his dream girl? Are we being too mean? You know, do you just want him to have his dream girl?
Would you give Calvin a swirly or a noogie? What would be your preferred method of physical bullying of this man boy?
Swirly, noogie, or wedgie?
Yeah, you got to choose one of the three. We'll set up a Twitter poll.
Yes, we will do that, actually.
Right, okay then.
All right. Bye.
Bye.